under fire, engulfed in crisis, cesspit of intolerance. These are just some of the headlines used to describe the debate on anti-Semitism currently raging within the British Labour Party. A debate reignited by party leader Jeremy Corbyn's support of a street artist who drew a painting showing Jewish bankers counting their money, apparently in the name of free speech. For Liverpool MP Luciana Berger, Corbyn's support of a mural shows he's turning a blind eye to anti-Semitism, he told MPs in March.
Pains me to say this, Madam Deputy Speaker, proudly as the chair of the Jewish Labour Movement in 2018, within the Labour Party, anti-Semitism is now more commonplace, it is more conspicuous, and it is more corrosive.
The media was fast to react. Too fast, perhaps, says Eileen Jan, who works with the Media Diversity Institute in the UK.
I think an issue like this can be sensationalised quite easily, which I think was definitely for some publication what they did. I think one of the things that was kind of forgotten was the broader issue of anti-Semitism in the UK, which, in my opinion, is a much more urgent issue. And I feel a lot of media outlets kind of forgot to mention that, or they briefly mentioned it, which I think was kind of a letdown.
Some of Corbyn's critics who consider him too left-wing also accuse him of complacency towards anti-Semitism, in some cases linking the charge to his support for the Palestinian cause, a charge he strongly denies. His supporters argue that anti-Semitism is being used as a weapon to discredit him ahead of next month's local elections. Jan says failure by news outlets to mention the political context was another oversight.
Definitely the comment Corbyn made had to be brought to light. I'm not saying that that shouldn't have been the case. But kind of looking at the political environment at the moment, you know, the fact that this comment was brought to light years after it happened, maybe some more investigative pieces looking at why was it brought to light now? This person brought the comment to light. What could their intentions have been besides wanting to highlight the potential anti-Semitism in the Labour Party?
Elsewhere, an anti-Semitic incident has also grabbed headlines in Germany. An Israeli wearing a kippah was recently attacked by a Syrian refugee in a trendy neighborhood of Berlin, with the attacker yelling Jew in Arabic. The video later went viral. The attack prompted a strong show of solidarity, but did little to dampen fears among Germany's Jewish community, who connect hatred of Jews today to that of Europe's past. But covering anti-Semitism isn't always easy, particularly when it comes to language, explains Eileen Jan from the Media Diversity Institute.
Often you see people using anti-Semitic language in either their headlines or the way they explain things without even really realizing it. Here in the UK, a few weeks ago, we had an issue surrounding an article about George Soros. He is a Hungarian businessman. He works for the Open Society Foundation. He has invested a lot of money into the Open Society Foundation. And the headline used kind of alluded to him being a puppeteer, which definitely has anti-Semitic backgrounds. But I think the journalists didn't intentionally do that. But I think people just need to be more aware of anti-Semitic phrases, language used. I think there needs to be a little bit more education on that. And we need to give Jewish community members a voice in this as well, you know, about how they are dealing with it, what their standpoint on it is.
A point of view shared by Jean-Yves Camus, director of the Observatory of Radical Politics here in Paris. The French capital, which has seen a string of killings of Jews, was recently hit by another anti-Semitic attack, this time against an elderly Jewish woman, prompting thousands to march in her memory, together with a manifesto signed by 300 intellectuals denouncing what they call a new wave of anti-Semitism inspired by radicalized Islamic minorities. While Camus commends the French media for tackling the problem head-on, he also accuses it of bias.
I'm really scared that the situation is only into the hands of a few intellectuals who sign manifestos and go on TV shows to tell their appreciation of what's going on. But we never have the possibility to listen to the voice of those who are concerned. I mean, to the average Jew living in a small town or in a suburb of Paris. The media don't go there.
The other danger is narrowing the conversation to reflect just one opinion, in this case that new anti-Semitism is the fault of Muslims. Camus says that's not the full story.
It's very difficult to find dissident voices. That's something that I really care about, because it looks like the Jewish community, the Jews in France, speak with only one voice, the voice of those people who say that today there is a problem with Islam. This is not so, but those who are in the minority, I belong to them, have a very hard time finding ways to have the mainstream media listen to what they have to say.
In Pakistan, news outlets like GOTV have also been finding it hard to have their say. The station, which is critical of the military, was recently shut down in most parts of the country. The government denied any responsibility. However, in a surprise move, GOTV was put back on Thursday the 19th of April after concluding a deal with the military. This deal, though, worries Daniel Bastar, head of the Asia-Pacific desk at Reporters Without Borders, comes with strings attached.
It's a very worrying precedent, because if GOTV wants to be broadcasted, it has to self-censor itself. That's the message the military wants to send. What gives us some hope, though, is that Pakistani journalists signed a petition last week after the case of self-censorship to denounce the behavior of the military and, of course, of their executive. So there is a will among Pakistani journalists to not bend toward the military and to promote a public debate ahead of next July elections.
Civil society groups in Pakistan say the freedom of the press is increasingly under attack, with the military accused of disappearing activists and journalists. Last December, for instance, 40-year-old Raza Khan, a Pakistani political activist, disappeared from his home. 4 months on, he's still missing. The consequence is that entire regions are going silent as news fails to get reported. Should everyone be allowed to report? In Tanzania, bloggers could soon have to pay a license of up to $1,000 just to be able to post content online. The government says it wants to protect the East African nation from lies being spread online. Lynette Kwamboka, a Mozilla Tech Policy Fellow in Nairobi, says she understands the government's concerns.
I can see where the government is coming from. I think we had the same case in Kenya where the journalists were calling for more responsibility among the bloggers because the journalists said, well, they have to go through school, they're taught all the ethics and the things they have to comply with to be able to write stories and be able to, you know, create content, especially about people, whereas bloggers generally tend to be more free thinkers with no regulation or accountability for any of the actions that they take or any of the stories that they put out.
Critics, though, are concerned that the government is using the excuse of regulation as a veil for repression. Last week, authorities arrested the country's top musician, Diamond Platnumz, after he posted a video clip of himself playfully kissing a woman on Instagram, which authorities said was indecent. Freedom of speech was one of the requirements for a healthy internet, as revealed in a report earlier this month by Mozilla Fox. Tech policy fellow Kwamboka explains what's needed for the internet to function well.
You also need to understand that free speech has consequences, that when you say something, yes, the government allows you to say it, but if you say something that offends the next person, there needs to be a level of responsibility. So for me, for a healthy internet, that needs to be there, the decentralization, to be able to understand who owns it and who is responsible for what. But then the most important thing, I think, there has to be a lot of privacy and security, that you need to know that you're in a safe space and not in a battleground every time you go online to express yourself or to be creative.
Tanzania's online regulations follow the arrests of several people charged with abusing the president, John Magufuli, a euphemism rather for criticizing him on Facebook and on WhatsApp. It's part of a growing trend of African governments trying to control what's said online. Kwamboka says they're fighting a losing battle.
I feel like there needs to be a better approach to this, and because this is going to be a battle that neither the government nor the bloggers are going to win at the end of the day.
When it comes to fighting censorship or anti-Semitism, journalists can't afford to lose.